Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. There was a national convening of the Movement for Black Lives in Cleveland last week, and a number of people from Baltimore were a key part of that and went to that meeting. Those people are joining some four of the folks who are here in the studio now with us to talk about what that meant in Cleveland, why it happened, what happened there, some of the controversies at that, at least that the press put out about what happened at that convention, and what it means for Baltimore, where we go in this city in terms of organizing and change. We're here with Marshall Eddie Conway. Eddie Conway, of course, former Black Panther who was released from prison in 2014 after being incarcerated for 44 years, author with Dominic Stevenson of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Black Panther. He's now a
executive producer.
That's what I thought the title was, and it needs to be. Executive producer at the Real News Network here in Baltimore, Maryland. Good to have you back in the studio, Eddie.
Okay.
Dominic Stevenson's with us, program director for the American Friends Service Committee. As I said, co-author with Eddie of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. Waqia Abdul Karim, performance artist, who is also in Cleveland. Good to have you in the studio for the first time, Waqia.
Hello,
welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Fanon Hill joins us by phone here, cultural organizer, co-founder, and executive director of the Youth Resiliency Institute, trainer for the National Rites of Passage Institute, who is from Cleveland, goes between both cities, and was there at the conference as well. And Fanon, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk at steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. You can log on to our Facebook pages. I'll check the website in a moment. But call 410-319-8888. Who to start with? Well, I'll start with Fanon, since you are a Cleveland and Baltimore, both at the same time. And talk about the genesis of this conference and what you did there.
Most definitely. You know, it was quite an honor to be in Cleveland during this period, during the gathering, of course, but even more so to be in Cleveland with Brother Eddie Conway, Sister Dominique Stevenson. I mean, it was surreal in many ways to see the reaction amongst many of the attendees, who were present in Cleveland, especially in light of what has transpired in Cleveland over the last months, over the last years, day to day, in terms of the police misconduct, the police violence. So, interestingly, being present in Cleveland during the gathering, the Black Lives Matter gathering, the convening, you know, there's an important backstory that I do want to share, and that backstory being that there were a number of organizers who actually were involved in the Huff riots that took place July 18th through the 23rd, 1966 in Cleveland, and also individuals who were involved in the Glenville shootout that took place July 23rd through the 28th in 1968. So in terms of the cross-generational opportunities that did exist, to have so many young organizers from throughout the United States and beyond present, and to be in the midst of the gathering, knowing that Cleveland continues to be, like many other cities, at the epicenter of a struggle that has been a long struggle, was quite robust and magnificent in many ways. So, you know, I want to stop there.
Okay. And Eddie, I mean, this is, you've done quite a bit of traveling over the last year since you've got out of prison, and have connected with a lot of movements. And you were there in the heart of the struggle back in the late 60s, 1970, before they took you away from us. So I'm curious with that perspective at this conference for you.
Well, it was like invigorating just to be there among so many young people. And I was there actually as a
reporter.
And so we actually interviewed like a number of people. And even though I participated in some of the panels, discussions, workshops, et cetera, my real interest was what did this mean for us, for the present and in the future. And it was exciting. The energy was exciting. The amount of young people there, the inclusiveness of the operation and organization was fantastic. Initially, it was a little concerned about whether or not it would come together and how it would come together and whether it would be logistically functional. But it was all worked out. I think it's good for the future.
Yeah, and I think it's amazing, this organization that came from the grassroots up, putting together a national conference. It's not like something like the NAACP or some other organization kind of organizing from the top down. This all came from the bottom up, which makes for a very different kind of conference. What was your experience there?
Welcome.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. Yes, so I went there pretty much as an artist living here in Baltimore City. And just, I guess, for the past year, just realizing that here in Baltimore City, as an artist, as a Black queer artist, there is a divide. And there is a conversation that needs to be had about, like, Black arts and white arts here in the city. And so, yeah, so I went there as a young person, just, like, needing to be in a space with other Black people. I went there, and I have to say that it was just the most inspiring, empowering place to be. I remember when I got there Friday night, but and I think there was something that took place Friday night involving a trans person that kind of sparked this conversation during the rest of the weekend about how are we going to be more inclusive of trans folks? How are we going to be more inclusive of women? How are we going to talk about immigration in this movement? And so I feel like those conversations were had, and people were just, everyone was open, and it was just this, like, shared, beautiful shared space that I was really grateful to be a part of.
Dominic, you've been in the movement a while yourself and have seen lots. I'm curious how you're taking this, because this is the movement that has exploded in America in the last several years since the videotaping of so much of the police brutality has exposed us to the nation in ways it never was exposed before every day. So I'm curious to see how different this was from what maybe you've felt or seen before.
Well, it's funny because, like, I've grown cynical about large gatherings.
Right.
You have social forums, you have this gathering or that gathering. So I kind of went with that cynicism and not knowing really what to expect. But once I got there, just the energy that I felt, and also from what I saw, it seemed to be, the majority of people seemed to be young people, maybe between 18 and 35. I spent a lot of time actually just sitting out in the courtyard talking to young people, really just listening.
Mm-hmm.
I was moved by the number of folks who are just really doing, on the grassroots level, doing work in their communities. And, like, we talked to this one brother who took the Greyhound bus for, like, 22 hours from Mobile, Alabama.
Wow.
To get there. So you saw that kind of energy where people felt the need to be there. Also, I felt like it was just the environment was very inclusive. And as a woman, I mean, a lot of times I don't feel that way. As a woman working, you know, mostly with men, I feel sometimes more like I have more of a voice inside of the prison with the men I work with than outside when it comes to speaking about the issues. And so for it to be led by women and led by young women was really, that for me was really powerful.
Can we explore that for just a minute? Some of the larger issues I want to explore as well. But, I mean, this is something that we've talked about in the air here. I've been experiencing just viscerally watching things happen and being part of some things. And seeing as how the major media doesn't really give this very much coverage, that a lot of this movement around the country has really been led by women. Women have always been at the forefront of the movements, but never gotten the limelight or the credit for being at the forefront of movements, whether it was SNCC or now, mm-hmm. right? Back in the day, Panthers or whatever else it was. So I'm curious about that. I mean, what change you see happening that way, because it's women at the center, and not just the center, but out in front, organizing, speaking, leading the demonstrations. What do you think that means? What do you think that, how does that shift things?
So not only do I feel like women are at the forefront, but I also think that queer people are at the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, yeah, so one of the conversations that started during the course of the conference was, if this is going to be a successful movement, if we are going to go forward, then we have to include other people's voices. We can't go for it without including more women's voices. We can't go for it without including more queer voices. And so I think that in doing that, in being more intersectional in that way, I think that the movement is going to sort of, it's going to be, I don't know.
Go ahead. Yes,
but yeah, I think that going forward, unlike past struggles where there were failures because of the way misogyny and homophobia kind of got into the movement, this won't happen now because people are sort of at the forefront and also like speaking about their own struggles and saying that this is also important.
Yeah, I think we still, like, we have a lot to work out, but I do feel like people are claiming space. Women, queers, folks are claiming the space. Folks are not simply allowing themselves to be elbowed out. You know, it's funny because I have a male friend who was also there who talked about feeling a little isolated. And I'm like, but that's how I always feel a lot of times as a woman.
All right.
And the difference is I don't think that his isolation was intentional. I don't think that that was intentional on the part of the organizers. It's just the simple fact that, you know, women are claiming space. Folks are claiming space that they have been taking up anyway in terms of doing the work and doing a lot of the organizing. When the protests were going on here, I saw women running around doing all kinds of things, from feeding folks to, you know, feeding the folks who were out protesting to just, you know, getting things together. So I think that we still have a lot to work on, and I think that we still have to have some very honest dialogues and conversations, you know, amongst ourselves about the issues that kind of keep us apart or split us up and keep us fractured. But to be there in that space at this time, it was a very powerful feeling for me as a woman.
And I, you know, I go to the phones here, 410-319-8888, and one thing I'd like to explore here is just what this new movement arising in America in these last several years, what you think politically it portends, what it means, what does it push America in a different way than has happened with movements before. Every movement in this country, from the Underground Railroad to the abolitionist movement to the civil rights movement to now, that whole arc, each step in the struggle has meant something different and pushed society in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what you think this particular movement building now is doing. What is it pushing that's 21st century, not things before? What is it saying to us differently?
Well, yeah, I want to jump in there because women have played an important role throughout history. I mean, throughout history. I don't think any movement, any growth, any development would have came into being without the majority of it being led and supported by women, even though men have always got the mic, have always got the camera, have
right.
always got the recognition. When you look, even in the Black Panther Party, when you look in the Black Panther Party, you'll see that the Black Panther Party existed for 16 years because of the input of women and sisters and young people, right? I think this today is a step beyond where the Black Panther was going. I think when we started seeing it was like, free us. You know, get us out of these chains, the abolitionist movement. At some point, it was like, stop segregating us. At some point, it was, give us our civil rights. When the Black Panther came, the party itself came, it was talking about human rights. But I think this movement takes up the banner of human rights. We're all are human beings on the planet, and the planet needs to be shared by everybody. And the resources need to be shared by everybody. I think that's what this movement is saying. It's taking up where the Panthers left off, where Malcolm X left off. It's taking up, we don't want civil rights. We're not talking about the right to vote, the right to this. We're talking about the right to being human beings and enjoying the fruits of the planet as human beings collectively. And I think that's where we go into the future. And that's the only way the human race goes into the future.
Okay, I'm going to get to you and Fanon before we go to break. Okay, so just to get your perspective on that, I mean, because you're young.
Yes.
Because you represent that body that's being talked about, and you're, you know.
Yes. I think for me, this movement means, like, a questioning of white culture as a whole, questioning institutions of power that we don't often question. Just like for me, I know as a young person, as someone who is college educated and who does exist in mainly white spaces, sometimes I feel like those are the only spaces in which I can advance as a person. And so now I think that this movement is sort of saying, no, like, those are not the only spaces for us. those institutions are not the only thing that nurture us and that give us strength and that allow us to move forward. And I think that this movement is about building new spaces, spaces that are Black, that are queer, that are led by women. And yeah, so we are at the forefront of sort of these institutions of power.
And what I was thinking, and Phenom, I'm going to get your word in here before we go to break here, and then go to the phones at 410-319-8888. I was thinking about this in terms of going on today. Last night I got home and I'm watching this documentary given to me by a Cuban radical thinker when I was in Cuba a few months back. And first time I've had a chance to look at it, and it's a film by Black Cubans about race in Cuba. A fascinating film that was done internally. And one of the lines in there was that, you know, in all the TV and in our schools, everything we learn is European descended. It's about Europeans. And then before we came on the air to here, there's two young men who work here as interns right now, really bright young guys, brothers. And one of them was looking at a book that he had to study for his school. And I said, what are you reading? He said, it's a book on mythology. So I said, oh, well, let me see which one. So, and it was the same book of mythology that I remember reading when I was 15 years old. And everything in the book is Roman or Greek and Eurocentric. Mm-hmm. Not a word about African gods and goddesses in mythology, not a word about Native American gods and mythology, mm-hmm. or even Asian, which is more accepted in many ways, right? In the iconography of our schools. So, fun on that. And I was just thinking about what was just said by Wakia, and I mean that to me is part of the heart of what we're talking about. Part of the heart.
Most definitely, you know, in. I think that you're getting to the heart of questions related to identity, which were discussed in Cleveland at the gathering. Jonathan Likas, tremendous organizer, did a lot of work with the Black Youth Project in Chicago, and he's a homeboy. He's from East Cleveland, Ohio, graduated from the same high school as I did. But nonetheless, we were able to discuss, the gathering in terms of us all questioning our identities, our identity in relation to those around us, our identities in relation to those who are pushed into the margins of the margins, who are in communities who have not been, often are not properly invited to share their wisdom, their truths, and their tactics within this protracted struggle. But the whole question of identity is very key, especially in terms of the work we do within the Rites of Passage, National Rites of Passage Institute, and the Youth Resiliency Institute around identity formation.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, you know, the individuals, institutions that develop iconology, and symbolism, icons, so on and so forth, that really dictate who we should be, who we're supposed to be. So being able to create spaces where we can be who our ancestors paid the price for us to be, being in spaces where we can, you know, learn from those who have been on the front line, who still have so much to share, is very, very, very important and very key.
We're going to take a very brief break here. We're going to come right back and hit to the phones and talk about some political issues and what organizing means and how this is going to, where the movement may be going in America and what we're building towards. And on our way to break, You're My Everything, The Temptations, came out today in 1967. Come Together by the Beatles, recorded on this day in 1969. We're right here as we talk about what happened at the Black Lives Matter conference that took place in Cleveland. Eddie Conway is with us, who is now an executive producer with the Real News Network. Dominique Stevenson, program director of the American Friends Service Committee. Wakia Abdul-Karim, who is a performance artist here in Baltimore. And Phenom Hill is co-founder and executive director of the Youth Resiliency Institute. And you at 410-319-8888. Can we go to the phones now? Yes? Yes, good, cool. 410-319-8888. Let's get to the phones. And Robert, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Rebecca Goon. Let me turn the video down.
Okay, oh, please.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Hey, look, I am absolutely ecstatic. You hear me? Young people now?
I hear you.
I am ecstatic. I encountered my fellow students at some of the demonstrations here in Baltimore. I see it all over the place. And as you both, you've all observed, the prominence of sisters in this is, it is just remarkable. But I have a question, maybe a kind of two-pronged question. One, I'm curious in terms of the Cleveland thing, what sort of, I don't know, maybe association, organization, or anything of that sort that, let's say you are expecting to come out of this. And I heard a brief interview yesterday with very brief Eddie Conway, and he was talking about the need to have independent organization, but also alliances. Are there plans along those lines coming out of the Cleveland meeting?
All right, let's take both those. They're really interesting questions. This goes right to the heart of where we wanted to go, which is where this kind of meeting takes people in their communities back, and what this next stage of struggle mean, and what you think that means. But let's talk to the first question first, and what comes out of this Cleveland meeting in a larger sense for the movement and what goes. And do you want to start, Joaquin, and then we can just go around the room and
get to sure. So it's interesting. I think probably – so about I guess it's a month or earlier this month, I was involved in this performance art festival that happened here in Baltimore. The title of the performance event that I was a part of was Racial Margins. It was curated by this group, Lab Bodies. During the performance, there were mostly women of color performing art pieces about race. And then that started sort of a larger conversation that I am now having with several women artists, black, mostly women artists here in Baltimore, about what can we do as artists moving forward to both create art, but also question systems of power here in the city. Even just things like I performed in a gallery space. A gallery space is typically not accessible to people outside of the art community, people who aren't college educated. And so as a black queer artist, and as someone who thinks about social justice and thinks about race, I'm trying to think of ways in which I can create art, but also question and like how to be more of an activist through sort of my art. And so that's what I'm thinking about moving forward. And that's kind of what I got from the space. I'm not an organizer in the typical sense, but I am interested in social justice. And so I want to create art that just questions and is accessible to a wide range of people, especially black people.
And did you want to jump in on that, Phenom, before we get to the other two folks in the room here?
Sure. Quickly, briefly, most definitely in terms of being in Cleveland, recognizing folk in Cleveland on the ground who have been active, who continue to be active, associations, collectives such as the Cleveland 8, Brother Abdul Kahar and New Black Panther Party. One of the things that I really was thrilled about was the question and understanding and ever evolving understanding of the need of recognizing that specific action has to be responsive to unique local needs. Right now I'm presently in Albemarle Square where, you know, the three women who have provided programming here in Jonestown with zero public or private funding for years. You know, you talk about dedication, self-determination, but in terms of how can activists, organizers, advocates from around the world support those who are doing the work at a local level and honor those who are doing the work at a local level so as once again they're able to share their solutions and their tactics. So coming out of the Cleveland convening, you know, I feel very, very confident and very excited about the prospect of paying closer attention to those, once again, who are on the margin of the margins doing the work, who must be part of this movement.
But please, Dominique.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about, you know, in terms of national structure where it goes. I think that probably one of the criticisms I would have about it is really the need to bring more people from the community, from the hood, real grassroots folks.
Okay? Right.
And not in a token way.
Mm-hmm.
you know, into that kind of space. But also, I think that those folks in that space need to really go back to communities and determine how can we partner, how can we work together. You know, I think that that's really key. I agree with what Fanon is saying, that it gets down to what's going to happen in people's individual cities, communities. You know, what kind of building are we going to do? Because we can't leave the hood behind. We can't leave those folks behind. Other than that, it will just then, you know, amount to talk. And I think it's very important to look at what we're doing to support people who are the most vulnerable to police abuse and police brutality, who are the most vulnerable economically, you know. So I think that that part really has to be worked out. What I did see there at the conference was a number of people who are, like, working on the grassroots level, but I think I would have appreciated it more had there been more folks. I think had I not been so cynical about gatherings, I probably would have made the effort myself to really bring folks that we work with from the community. But I really didn't know, you know, what to expect. And was pleased once I got there. But, you know, there have been a lot of gatherings that have never, you know, you have annual gatherings that don't necessarily amount to a lot of organizing.
Absolutely. And that's always been a problem movement-wise in this country. Mm-hmm. People come to talk, but then Virgil comes out of the talk.
Yeah.
And beyond that. And what was he referring to when he was talking about what you were talking about, the need to build movement and alliances? What was that about?
Well, I think I did an interview while I was there, and I think it was on Democracy Now! Apparently.
Okay. Right.
And I was saying, and similar to what's been said here, is that the need is to get back to the community, go down in the community, challenge the institution in the community, interact with the people down in the community, work to build a stronger community, work to build alternative institutions, work to build institutions that address our needs, but at the same time recognize that there's other movements, whether it's immigration, whether it's environmentalists, whether it's workers' rights, et cetera, whatever it is, recognize those other movements and that other organizing and have them as allies, but maintain and build the structures that we need to build, you know. But the only people that's going to determine where this go is young people, because this is their time.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly.
And this is their energy.
Right. And it is. I think that's something that we, many older people kind of forget, that every movement that has been built in this country, that has exploded the change in this country, has been built by people who are in their late teens, their 20s and 30s, who are the ones who kind of push the envelope, which is and make things happen. I mean, every movement, SNCC, the Panthers, all the way back to the abolitionist movement. It was young people who were pushing this and saying, we'll make the change. It was young people who led the flight from enslavement to say, we're not going to be enslaved, we're going to fight against this. I mean, that was always that. So that is the energy that has to be here. And I was thinking, though, that there are a couple of things that, I don't know if you heard about this, before I get away from it, I wanted to say this. We see all the time about people being arrested by police and found dead, right? Mm-hmm. I got an email yesterday that just is about a guy named Rexdale Henry, who was a Choctaw man in Mississippi, who was arrested on suspicious traffic charges, and he was found dead in his jail cell. A healthy man who works in his community, fighting for justice and working with kids, and he's dead. And in the very same county where the very same jail that held Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. Mm-hmm. I just want to throw that out there. I want people to know this because people are not reporting that this happens. Mm-hmm. And you all just got back from Cleveland, and there's a woman in Cleveland named Ralkina Jones,
yep,
who nobody knows what happened to, and she died in her cell.
Mm-hmm.
A young woman, perfectly healthy. What happened to her? I mean, this is happening. I mean, you know, stuff has been happening all the time, but now we see it. And I mean, so the part of the movement I know is fueled by this angst and anger and frustration and tiredness and rage over these kind of things that are happening. That is part of the focal point. So I don't know why I just raised all that to say, because I get infuriated about it. It turns me into a rage, and I try to keep calm because I have to host the show. But it's not easy to keep calm, Fanon, when you watch this thing happen day in and day out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that also speaks to just the importance of understanding this is a protracted struggle.
Mm-hmm.
The young people who are getting ready for first grade, for kindergarten, in terms of they can show that they're prepared, there, equipped with the proper tools to be able to address these issues as they come of age in this nation, in this world. Understanding those who have been on the front line for years, who have been, you know, sacrificed everything, you know, for young people to be able to be free and to be able to speak their truth. So it's a protracted struggle, and I mean, we've got to be aware of every incident, if at all possible, that transpires in every community.
Yeah, I think because, one, it is a protracted struggle, I think what is really at the epicenter is this long history of oppression. Mm-hmm. The emotion is, those are layers, that those are responses, that's feeling, you know, but really the root of it is the fact that this has been consistent since 1492.
Amen.
Okay, and it's almost like encoded in our DNA at
this
point.
It is encoded, I think, in our DNA.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I just wanted to say, when we were talking about youth being always being at the center of these movements too, don't discount like the fact that you had women like Gloria Richardson was in her 40s when she was
pushing
that bayonet out her face.
That's right.
Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, those women were always there. You know, so women of all ages, I think, have always participated.
Important point. Very important point. Let me get one quick call in here before the end, and that closing thoughts from Joaquin and Eddie before we have to go to our next segment. 410-319-8888. Gene in Pikesville, you're on the air. Pardon me.
Yeah, I guess it's still good morning, everybody.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah, but I was just thinking and listening to you guys. I was thinking of President Obama and the way he presented a question or presented the a solution in a sense that there are sympathetic ears in place in positions of power, and that he requested that we formulate the answer. And make him do things that are necessary to be done. You know, you talk about historians, Adam Clayton Powell and Stokely Carmichael. I think were in the same position. In the '60s with the Black Power movement, and I think we find ourselves in that place. Jill Carter is another person that came to mind who expresses some of the sentiments that I hear you guys talking about. And she wants to be drafted to put herself in place so that she can implement and articulate some of the things that are necessary within the Black community. So I just wanted to say that.
All right, Gene, I appreciate you calling and being part of the show. And let me get some final thoughts here. And let me turn, first of all, Akia Abdul-Karim, and then a closing thought from Eddie Conway before we have to get to our next segment.
Yeah, so I think for me, as a young person living in the United States right now, it is very easy to become cynical about everything that's going on. It is very easy to feel like I can't fight. You know, racism is it's deeply embedded in the framework of this country. And so just to be there this weekend, to be in a space with all of these people who are doing amazing work, and not just doing amazing work, but like all of these people who are like, they want to hold you up, and they want to like embrace you, they want to nurture you. That alone felt amazing and great and necessary. And it did give me sort of like this sense of like, I can go back to my community. I can go back to these white spaces and make a difference and do something that will sort of lead to actual change.
Eddie, final closing thought in all this?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that there's 2.3 million people in prison in America. And I think part of Black Lives Matter movement needs to recognize that we have a tremendous amount of our population not only being dehumanized, you know, but isolated from our community. And we need to make that connection also, because these are people, brothers and sisters at an alarming rate, that's disappearing from our community, that will return to our community at some point. So we need to also connect in that kind of way.
I want to thank the four of you. It's been great. Eddie Conway's been with us, an executive producer at The Real News Network. and Dominique Stevenson, Program Director for American Friends Service Committee, Waqia Abdul-Karim, performance artist, Fanon Hill, co-founder and executive director of Youth Resiliency Institute, all of whom came back from the Black Lives Matter conference in Cleveland. Thank the four of you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And the struggle continues, and we'll continue having these folks in the program to see where we're moving to. We're going to take a very brief break with Peace of Mind by Idris Muhammad, who passed away on this day in 2014. And when we come back, we will look at public health in our community. Stay with us.